You don't have to be a believer to be intrigued by the image of Joseph Smith made public last week. The story came from a scholarly paper produced for the Community of Christ. It's a church that separated from the original LDS faith in the early days of the Mormon movement. And the paper lays out the exhaustive process of authenticating a small daguerreotype mounted inside a gold locket. The paper's authors believe it's the only known photograph of Joseph Smith, taken a few months before he was killed in 1844. Smith's wife, Emma, and in fact most of his direct descendants, were part of the Community of Christ. And the paper traces that likely line of possession of the locket from Emma and the other women, eventually down to Lois Smith Larson, Joseph Smith's great-granddaughter. And that is how Daniel Larson ended up with it. And here's a twist you should know before you hear the story. Daniel Larson left the Community of Christ several years ago to join the original LDS Church.
My mother passed away in 92. She gave me a box of family heirlooms about 2 months before she passed away. And so I brought that stuff home, put it in my safe. Probably 6 months or so after that, I finally, with my wife, went down and got that stuff and just kind of looked at it. But the main two things was a large pocket watch that was my great-grandfather, Joseph Smith III, with his initials on the front. And then there was a small, what I called a watch locket. And I tried to get it open, but the button on the top was bent, and I couldn't open it. So I just put it all back in the box. 28 years later, 10:30 or so on a Saturday morning, we took all of the artifacts and heirlooms that I got from my mother and brought those up to go through them. We put it all out on the table, and the things that really caught my eye were the two watches, the watch and the watch locket. I opened my great-grandfather's watch. The other one, which I thought was a watch, I tried to get it open, and I pried on it a little bit with my letter opener. I didn't damage it at all, and it just popped open. It's a photo or something, but I couldn't see the image. Have you seen a lot of daguerreotypes of that period? If you don't have a light directly on them, you can't see the image. So then I put a light directly on it, straight on it, and that image came out, and it was just clear as a bell. My wife was in the other room upstairs, and I called her and I said, "You've got to come in and see this." I looked into his eyes, and I knew that that was Joseph Smith. There's no doubt in our mind that that's who it is. It just looks like he's looking right through you, like he's really there. I don't know how I guess to express the feeling. I guess I could use the word spiritual. But I always said that if we could ever just see the image, the real man, that would be a real blessing. That blessing happened that morning. It's quite the find. In all of Mormon history artifacts and articles, this is the find.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So the first person Daniel Larson called that day was his nephew, Lachlan Mackay. He's a leader in the Community of Christ, and he took on the project of trying to authenticate the daguerreotype with a scholar and historian named Ron Romick. Now, if you're following the family tree part of the story, Mackay is Joseph Smith's great-great-great-grandson. So he's got skin in the game, but he's also pretty circumspect about Smith's life and reputation.
in Community of Christ, we, I think, are comfortable with the idea that our leaders and our members live life in the gray. The world is not black and white, true or false, good or evil. We're all capable of doing amazing things, and we all make mistakes at times. So I've always been pretty comfortable with Joseph as somebody who made some really good decisions and made some poor ones. Hmm. Never had him on a pedestal, which means never had to knock him off a pedestal.
I wonder, and we don't need to spend too much time with this, but I do wonder what how your impression, or a member of the Community of Christ, how that impression of Joseph Smith differs from members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints headquartered here in Salt Lake City. Do you find a distinction there, I guess?
I'm guessing that just like in Community of Christ, people are all over the place.
Huh.
I'm guessing the same is true in the Church of Jesus Christ. But I guess there's another layer to my relationship with him because I'm a great, great, great grandson.
Yeah.
So that complicates it a little bit. Mm. But beyond that, I read the same books as everybody else.
Yeah.
So have never really felt any special sense of connection.
Growing up, had you heard the stories that there was a photograph or something like that out there?
Probably not growing up, but in the early 1990s when I first got interested in Latter-day Saint history and started researching with Ron Romig, my co-writer on this recent article, we spent a lot of time working on this question, and it seemed pretty clear that Smith family members believed there was a daguerreotype somewhere in the family. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that belief, a number of scholars believed there was a daguerreotype somewhere in the Joseph Smith III family.
And what did you think about that? Were you personally intrigued or professionally intrigued by the possibility?
Yeah, I was quite interested because I spent three decades studying visual images of Smith family members, including Joseph. And I'm working with, again, Ron, my research partner, found what's probably the first photograph of Lucy Max Smith, Joseph's mother, in another Smith descendant's home. It seems kind of ridiculous that I'm involved in a number of these major Smith family finds, but because they're family, I'm in their attics, I'm in their basements, I'm the person they call when they find something.
Yeah. So really, before the daguerreotype emerged, what was there that gave people a sense of what Joseph Smith actually looked like?
So there, in the 19th century, were two images that really almost everything else is based on throughout the 19th century. Mm. There's an 1842 David Rogers oil portrait.
Right.
Rogers, a New York City artist who and a Latter-day Saint who came to Nauvoo for a few weeks. And then there are Sutcliffe Maudsley profiles. Mm-hmm. He would trace your profile and then fill it in. And I am still looking for the source on that. I know I've run across it, though. Joseph is described as a fine-looking man from the front, not so fine from the side. And I think the profiles capture that. Joseph III wasn't a fan of those profiles. Mm-hmm. So he was very intentional about making an image of the portrait available by supplying a daguerreotype of that portrait to a photographer by the name of Charles W. Carter in 1885. Mm. Carter photographed the daguerreotype, touched it up, began to sell it, and that begins kind of the rise of the Rogers view in the West. And eventually, almost everybody who's a Latter-day Saint has imprinted on this 1842 oil portrait. But the problem is that, of course, portrait painters at the time we're not trying to do a photographic copy of you. They were trying to make you look heroic and almost mythological, make you look refined, like you never spent a day in your life in the field. You didn't work.
Right.
So noses were longer, mouths with, not as wide, lips thinner, hair straighter, skin smoother. The portrait is what we think of, but I have a plastic surgeon friend who said for years, nobody looks like that. That is not the face of a real person.
Yeah. So take us to March of 2020 and you getting this call from your uncle.
Yeah, so pandemic, you know, is upon us and everybody's a little panicked. We're all locked down. And in Nauvoo, not only was the pandemic shutting things down, a local bridge was out to be replaced. So there was nobody here. Nobody here. It was a ghost town. And I got this call from my uncle. He had stumbled across again after 28 years some artifacts that his mom had given him in 1992. Among them was a Joseph Smith III monogram pocket watch. And then this second object, which my uncle thought was a watch when his mom gave it to him, he couldn't get it open. The release mechanism was kind of sticky. So he had put those away and forgotten about them. He had more time on his hands in 2020. When he found it, he started working with it and was able to get it open. And it turns out it's not a pocket watch, yeah. Although it looks just like one from the outside. It is instead a piece of Daguerrean jewelry. So there was the face of a man looking back at him when he opened it. He called me, then he sent me an image. I immediately looked at it and said, I don't think that's Joseph. But I'm not particularly visual. But I called, with Dan's permission, my research partner, Ron Romig, and he looked at it and he said, I think it could be Joseph. In fact, I think he said, I think it is Joseph.
Wow.
But let's do the work on it. So that launched us into 2 years plus of research.
Later, and we'll get to this, the project of trying to, you know, authenticate it. But once you did learn, and once you came to believe that's Joseph Smith, what do you see in that image? What do you see now in that, as you said, gaze?
I think I see somebody who folks would choose to follow, despite being driven from place to place, and they didn't give up, which has always kind of amazed me. But I think I see the charisma that he is described as having. It is a pretty intense gaze. Parley P. Pratt, another church leader, describes Joseph as basically being able to look into your heart and beyond, into the eternities, which I think is a little overblown. But I think I can see that in those eyes.
What do we know about the person who took the daguerreotype?
We're not certain who took the daguerreotype, but the best candidate is Lucian Foster. He is a branch president or a congregation leader for the church in New York City. He moves to Nauvoo, arrives 2 months to the day prior to Joseph's death. And at least one account suggests he's living in the Mansion House. He is exhibiting his work in the Mansion House. There's uncertainty about whether or not he was in business before Joseph's death. He is advertising by early August of 44, his services. But he had gone on a campaign mission for Joseph's run for United States president as well. So he's probably really only here about 6 weeks of the 2 months that he lived here before Joseph's death. And for me, kind of an interesting piece was that he's coming from New York City, and the church newspaper there, The Prophet, it is advertising Daguerrean lessons, equipment, supplies in May of 44. And they are advertising, among other things, Daguerrean lockets, which, of course, is what this object is.
Yeah. So you learn about this daguerreotype. Where do you start in trying to authenticate it? Where do you figure you're going to begin?
So we were hoping for an easy process. Huh. And the easiest one would have been to disassemble it and find maker's marks and a name and a date inside, which occasionally happens with daguerreotypes. But through a friend at the Nelson Art Gallery in Kansas City, she connected me with one of their curators who works with daguerreotypes. They connected me with a local expert who connected us with the miniaturist who had the skill set to carefully take the locket apart, hoping for names, dates, etc. Unfortunately, none of that was inside.
So where do you go from there?
So then we started thinking about things like facial recognition software.
You do have a death mask, right? That's something to go by.
Yeah, there's a death mask, and then there's that 1842 oil portrait.
Yeah.
Of course, facial recognition software works best when you're comparing multiple known images of a person with a potential image of a person. We didn't have that, so we did our best and found a company that would work with us to compare the daguerreotype with the portrait with the death mask. And they came back saying that there was a 19 of 21 points within the 5% realm, that which they thought meant was moderate relationship. And in the terms of facial recognition software, that apparently is positive. We recognize, though, that this is kind of on the edge of what facial recognition can do. this is a piece of the puzzle. It is not the key to unlocking it. So that's an objective way that we were trying to learn more about it. We also were doing some subjective things like hiring a forensics artist with 40 plus years of experience to do overlays, transparencies, facial feature tracing, 50-50 cutaways, all those kinds of things. And we also knew that we needed to learn more about the provenance, and we also knew we needed to learn more about the artifact, meaning what is it, when were these kinds of things made? Is the daguerreotype plate itself consistent with the 40s? Is the locket consistent with the 40s? Mm. Is the clothing appropriate? The answer to those questions was all yes. So it's consistent artifactually with the mid-1840s. And then I mentioned earlier, I think, this Lucy Mack Smith. It's a photograph of a daguerreotype. It is also a circular daguerreotype. At the time we found it, we thought it was a button. But as we kept working on it, we realized now that it is almost certainly a circular locket insert, just like the Smith-Larson daguerreotype, but it's not set into a locket. And we know that it would have been created at least by December of 1845, because a painting based on it is hanging in the Nauvoo Temple by December of 46. So that tells us the Smith family had access to the technology and is using it by at least the mid-1840s. Obviously, it has to be before June of 44, yeah, if this is really Joseph.
Yeah. How helpful was the death mask?
I think the death mask has been quite helpful, but it is also not perfect for this project. Mm. It's all we got, but yeah, it is a piece of art, and it is made probably a day or so after Joseph's death,
yeah,
maybe a little earlier, but it's summer. There is mm-hmm. likely trauma from his assassination as well as the natural processes that come following death. So
right,
I think all of those things would impact it a little bit as well.
You know, it's interesting when you look at the, like when you see the death mask, when you see the portrait, however idealized it might be, when you compare that to the photograph, there are distinctive features. A frown line on the left side of this of his face, that, I think it's the left side anyway, that seems distinctive. I wonder if you're looking for those kinds of points as a tell.
We are. And the frown line is one of them that really captured me, because I had never noticed the frown line in the portrait, even though it's obviously there. There's also a bulge under the left lower lip. There is a heavy left lower eyelid. Mm. There is the beginnings of marionette line on the right corner of his mouth. The way the hair falls over the ears matches between the painting and the daguerreotype. The things that don't match, we expected going in would not match, because we know from comparisons of the death mask to the portrait that the artist made the nose in the portrait too long, and he made the mouth too small, the lips too thin, and all of those things don't work between the death mask and the portrait, and don't work between the daguerreotype and the portrait, but they do match between the daguerreotype and the death mask.
What was the moment when you were convinced? Was there a moment when you thought, I think this is Joseph Smith?
You know, there probably was, but it really was the weight of the evidence versus one aha moment. If there was an aha, it's when I really started looking at that frown line. And I had convinced myself it was a scar. The plastic surgeon that has looked at it for us, the cosmetic surgeon, thinks that it's likely not, that it really is a frown line. So, but either way, I was like, for me, that kind of felt like the closer, but I recognize that that is just one piece, and that he is not the only person that has an off-centered frown line on one side.
Is there a lingering question or issue that you can't really resolve? The provenance itself before 1992, that's obviously in question, but you seem to have sort of settled that in your mind. Is there one thing you wish you could really nail down to be completely sure? Or is there always going to be a question about this?
I believe that there will be more sources that turn up that will continue to help us better understand the object and the image. I do wish that some of Joseph III's statements were more clear. Mm. He does say on a number of occasions, I have a daguerreotype of my father made by Lucian Foster or by Foster. But it's clear that sometimes he's talking about a daguerreotype of the oil portrait.
I see.
This is not lingering for me, but a question for folks I'm seeing online who have not really spent much time with it yet. And I don't think they've read our journal article yet, but I am hearing questions about Hiram. I think this looks more like Hiram.
Right. But based on what,
morning,
though?
Well, I don't know. but I did remember this morning, that's not been the focus of my research, because I don't think that Joseph's granddaughter would wear lovingly for more than three decades a photograph of her great uncle who she never met. Hmm. But you know, I guess maybe, but all the images I am aware of Hiram made during his lifetime show him with sideburns, including some made near the end of his life, the Maudsley profile. Hmm. So Hiram had sideburns, and the person in this daguerreotype does not have sideburns.
So I guess that gets us to the reaction that you're seeing now since you made this public. What does all of that reveal, do you think, about Joseph Smith as such a, you know, polarizing figure in history?
Yeah, I think it reveals more about the way we think and feel about him today than it reveals anything about Joseph, other than the fact that he was human, which we already knew, but maybe some of us didn't. You know, there was a Smithsonian, algorithm a few years back that talked about the impact of historical figures on social media based on how many searches and blogs and Facebook posts and on and on and on. And it's clearly got an English language bias, but they came out with Joseph as the most historically significant religious figure in U.S. history. So love him or hate him, he's a really important historical figure. So for people to see this image, whether they despise him and then now they have to face to despise, or whether they revere him. And in some cases, that has been a little difficult because we've had these mythological views from the portraits, and suddenly we're seeing the real person. And that is an uncomfortable adjustment for some. We have imprinted on that portrait. We kind of have to rewire a little bit our brains to consider that this person in the daguerreotype is Joseph.
Mm. What should happen to this image? Where should it end up? Should people be able to see it? Should it be in a museum? Where should this be?
So daguerreotypes don't do well if you leave them open on exhibit for extended periods of time. So my hope is that the object could be on exhibit at times, but as much as I wish I had a say, I don't. It's my uncle's.
And
that decision rests with him.
Well, he wants it in the LDS History Museum in downtown Salt Lake City. I'm imagining you may feel conflicted about that.
He is a member of the Church of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And so I respect his wishes. And I'm the kind of person who is comfortable recognizing what I have a say in and what I don't.
Let me ask you finally, again, whether it's an actual image of Joseph Smith doesn't change, you know, the basics, right? But why does this matter to you that this is an actual daguerreotype, or does it? Does it matter in the big scheme of things?
I'd say for me, it matters, and kind of returning to a reoccurring theme, because it makes him human. It makes him a man. It makes him relatable. It just feels much more comfortable than the kind of weird looking person in that oil portrait. So, and you know, to have all these descriptions that people have collected through the years, and finally to be able to see what that really looked like, it has been really satisfying for me to have an answer to that enduring mystery.
Lachlan Mackay, thank you very much.
Loved talking. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you.
That's Lachlan Mackay. He's an apostle in the Community of Christ. Along with the historian Ron Romig, he worked to authenticate the Joseph Smith photo. They wrote about their work in a journal article. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is proud to be listener-focused and listener-supported public radio. We're grateful for our community of donors and sustainers who make monthly contributions to the station. If you rely on our programming to stay informed, become our newest sustainer with a gift of just $5 a month. Or consider an increase to your existing contribution. Get started today at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the photographic image revealed to the public last week that could be of Joseph Smith. Jenna Reese covered the story for the Religion News Service. It's one of the reasons we reached out to her this week. The other one is that she's a Latter-day Saint, and she pays a lot of attention to how church members react to things like this. Now, the Smith photo is actually a daguerreotype, and it's really small, inch and a half, and it's set inside a gold locket. For years, it sat in a box full of family heirlooms until one of Joseph Smith's great-great-grandsons thought to pry it open. And it's a good story. Jenna Reese did wonder if maybe it was a bit too good.
It sounds like an episode of Antiques Roadshow. You know, here is the thing that we've all been thinking all these years probably existed somewhere, and then it turns up in someone's attic or someone's basement or garage. The story has that element to it, which is very compelling and interesting, but should also give us pause. If this is something that we've been looking for and wanting, are we a little maybe too quick to believe it? I think that the evidence is strong for this, stronger than for any other previously discovered photograph of Joseph Smith. But new evidence may come to light, and other experts are going to be weighing in on this, so we will see what happens. It's fascinating, though, isn't it?
It really is. Everything about it's fascinating, I think, and we'll talk about some of those things, like just the reaction to it itself. But let me ask, beyond the question of evidence or verification, that seems to be a bit of a holdup for you, at least now. It hasn't been completely verified entirely. But is there anything beyond that about this story that makes you reluctant or reticent? Is there anything personal reticence about all of this, if that makes sense?
I would personally love for this to turn out to be genuine. So, you know, perhaps that will make people take what I say with a grain of salt because I am admitting that I want this to be true, right? But I think that it would be very interesting to have a real from life daguerreotype of Joseph Smith to demonstrate the ways in which he has been idealized in his other portrayals. This is a human being that we're seeing in the photograph. And his face is that of someone who has probably been through a lot, someone who has spent many hours in the sun, as somebody commented to me, that it looks like what we know about him, which is that this is someone who spent time deforesting New York and Pennsylvania. You know, this is someone who spent a lot of time outdoors, and there's a certain ruggedness to him that is missing from particularly the David Rogers portrait of him, the oil painting that is, you know, kind of famous and iconic about him. And so he comes across as more of a real human being, flesh and blood, flaws and all. And that is a very interesting twist on the Joseph Smith story for either people who are part of the faith and already thought of him as a prophet, or for people who have thought of him as a fraud or charlatan. I don't know that the daguerreotype is going to change their minds. I think that's become pretty clear on social media that, if anything, it has only entrenched people in their previously held view of Joseph Smith. But it is an interesting kind of human facet of Joseph Smith that we perhaps have been missing.
There's that question of whether a snapshot of a fraction of a moment can actually reveal anything at all about a person's character. And of course, that applies here. But in the moments when you entertain the possibility that maybe this is Joseph Smith. What else do you see in that image? You mentioned a life well-lived, right? People are talking about maybe some fatigue there, some wear and tear there. But do you see something else? Do you see an intensity there? Clearly, he's a handsome guy.
He is, and probably all the more so because of that sense of reality, that sense that this is not just a pretty face, but rather a face that has been through a lot. Some of the reactions on social media have been really interesting. One of my favorites was from someone who is, I think, no longer a member of the church and said the photograph for her matched the whole pedophile narrative of Joseph Smith. And by that, she meant that the Joseph Smith of the painting, she said, was not someone she would even follow into a Walmart, but the Joseph Smith of the photograph, she said, I get it now. There is something mesmerizing about his eyes, and that was commented upon by Joseph Smith's contemporaries in the 19th century, that he had these piercing eyes. And that comes through in the photograph, if this is in fact Joseph Smith, far more than in any other image I've seen of him or portrayal I've seen of him.
Does he look old for his age? I mean, he died at 38. This image, if it is Joseph Smith, would have been taken in his 30s. I wonder what it reveals about life, you know, living on the frontier of America at the time. As you say, there wasn't a lot of sunscreen in those days. And
exactly.
Right?
Yes. Well, I think that we ought not to be comparing what a 38-year-old person would look like today versus what a 38-year-old person would look like in a photograph then, partly because they didn't have any techniques for touching up photographs and the technology was not great, but also because people had leathered skin. People had skin that had pockmarks because they'd had smallpox or other illnesses that marked them forever. They had scars for which there was no facial surgery from a childhood injury. All of those things, I'm not saying that all of those happened to Joseph Smith, but just to put it in context of what we're looking at in a photograph from that period versus today.
I want to come back to this idea that you've described as reception history. One of the things that interests you as an historian, you've told us, is this idea of how something is received. And on the matter of his looks, noted LDS apologist Daniel Peterson, I was reading recently, wrote a piece defending the image of Smith against those who said it looked a bit haggard. You know, he said, look, he'd been persecuted. You know, he had borne the responsibility of this controversial new faith. But to the idea of how people are responding, what is the reception of this daguerreotype telling you about Joseph Smith? I guess, as you said before, it just confirms what we already knew. He was a remarkably polarizing figure.
That has been the theme, I think, for these tweets, these Facebook posts, TikTok videos that people have been posting. I think there are very few in which someone says, wow, this has really changed my mind about what I thought about Joseph Smith. I don't see that. Instead, what I see is that people who already were of the opinion that Joseph Smith was not a true prophet or that he was a horrible person are finding confirmation in that, including one person who was putting together an image of a young girl from the 19th century with this photograph of Joseph Smith and saying, you know, this is what it would have looked like for him to have married a 14-year-old girl in this time period. So I think they probably already had that view of Joseph Smith. There's nothing that the photograph is necessarily challenging about that view or adding to that view. But then on the other hand, I've seen people saying, aha, he really is a prophet of God. You know, this is absolute proof that this is someone who saw God and spoke to God, and you can see it right there. So I think that people are seeing, there's eisegesis going on, right? We're bringing to the photograph what we want to see or what we expected to see.
For those who say it's not him and are adamant about that, what does that tell you, do you think?
Isn't it interesting how quickly people will assume a position and that's the hill they're going to die on and there is no other hill, there never was any other hill? It's fascinating to me because, you know, I posted the link to the Religion News Service coverage of this. And normally after I will put something on social media for RNS, I go and walk the dog, or I am, you know, looking at some other work or answering emails or doing something else. I'm not following how it is addressed or on social media. I come back to it maybe later. But this time I sat there for over an hour monitoring how people were responding, and then later on throughout the day, because I was really interested. Are people as interested in this story, first of all, as I am? Because I think this is a fascinating possibility. It turns out that yes, people were very interested in it. But the larger question of, does this change what we know or believe about Joseph Smith? And I think so far the answer is no. People are already that entrenched in their view. What, though, is perhaps different now is that suddenly, overnight, everyone is an expert about facial recognition software or provenance of artifacts in the 19th century or death masks. And so they are very adamant about their position. I noticed that, for example, and this is, I think, a legitimate question, is it possible that this image could be of Hiram, that some of these other possibilities exist of other males in the Smith family? And so it's been interesting, though, people aren't just raising the question, could this be Hiram? There is a whole Team Hiram, almost a hashtag of Team Hiram, of people who are claiming that that it's definitely Hiram. And everybody loves a conspiracy theory. You know, everybody loves to believe that there's hidden knowledge, there's some esoteric meaning hidden in there somewhere. And I think that the idea that there is an even deeper possibility that is beyond the superficial one that we think it might be is universally appealing.
Whether it's actually a real image of the actual Joseph Smith doesn't, as you said, doesn't change any of the material facts about his life. But if you're a Latter-day Saint, does it matter to have an actual daguerreotype, an actual real image now?
I would like to believe that it matters. I would like to believe that members of all of the Restoration traditions, the LDS Church included, would be able to look at this and recognize the humanity, recognize that this is not just an icon, this is not just someone who we believe spoke with God, but this was a flesh and blood human being who had very real problems, who had family issues, probably far more so than most of us, and that the humanity of Joseph Smith would come through. Because frankly, you know, as a member of the LDS tradition, I feel like a lot of that humanity has been lost. You know, we don't teach about Joseph Smith as a flesh and blood human being, and upholding him constantly as this paragon of righteousness and virtue at all times has, I think, been damaging in the long run in our church, because some people feel that they don't necessarily relate to that Joseph Smith, and therefore maybe there's not a place for them in this faith. And hopefully people will begin having conversations. It would be wonderful, if I'm just dreaming aloud here, about does my view of the religion change if Joseph Smith, if I can accept this as a human being with wonderful qualities and also some very serious flaws, just like all of us.
Do you think this will ever be settled? That we'll know for sure this, oh, that's Joseph Smith, or nope, that's not Joseph Smith? Do you think we'll ever know?
That's a great question. Sometimes historians have to be comfortable with ambiguity in a way that many people find frustrating. And history is built upon evidence upon evidence upon evidence. And it's a long process. We want to be able to believe overnight that something can be validated. I think, as I said, this has more credibility and verification than most other documents. And it certainly has more recorded provenance of how this artifact came through the Smith family, even though it's not complete and there are possibly gaps in that story. That's still a lot more than we know about most objects from the 19th century, who owned them and where they were and how they were housed. So it's certainly better. But as to whether there's going to ever be any definitive, sure knowledge about whether this is real or genuinely Joseph Smith, I would have to say probably not. People will continue to have informed opinions, but that that definitive knowledge. It's not like in history someone comes down from on high and says, aha, you know, this is the real artifact. We have to become comfortable with some level of not knowing everything.
Jenna Reese, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Jenna Reese, she's an historian and a senior columnist for Religion News Service. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
A broken down or unused vehicle can be a hassle. Declutter your driveway by donating your unwanted vehicle to NPR Utah. Vehicle donations help fund the public radio programming and local independent journalism that you rely on from KUER, and they're even tax deductible. KUER accepts cars, trucks, motorcycles, SUVs, and even boats. And we'll handle every step of the process. Learn more and get started today at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So let's say the photographic image revealed to the public last week actually is of Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism. So what? As we've already heard, it doesn't confirm anything about history or about Smith's character. But what it does do is show us what he actually looked like. And whatever you think about Joseph Smith, that is something. This is obvious, I guess, but a real photo taken in the immediacy of the moment just gives you something you'll never get from a painting. Or at least that's what Peter Fetterman told us. Fetterman is a well-known photography collector. He has a new book out, a curated selection of the images he's collected over the years. It's called The Power of Photography. And Fetterman believes a photo can have a powerful impact on how we see people.
Well, I think the impact is so much greater when you're presented with a visual, actual representation of the figure you're interested in or want to know more about or move by. It just brings the whole personality of the person alive.
What interests you about all of this? What drew you to photographs, and what that relationship between the image and what they tell us? What interests you about that?
Well, I was born in a very kind of poor family, and both my parents had left school at age 13, so it was a household without any books. So I was a voyeur. I've always been a voyeur. I always want to learn about other people. I want to learn about things I know nothing about. And photography, for me, became that medium. It was a natural methodology of me discovering the world.
So tell us, what do you see, Peter, in the Joseph Smith daguerreotype? You don't bring the same kind of baggage to the story of a critic or of a follower. What do you see in it?
I think I see this is a man who has he's on a mission, and he's very determined, and he's very focused, and nothing is going to stop him in whatever he's attempting to do.
And where are you looking for that? Is it? I guess is it centered in the eyes? Is that as someone who looks at photographs? Is it the eyes that you look to first?
I think in any great portrait, your eye goes to the sitter's eyes. You can tell a lot by somebody's gesture, by their look. Many of the great portraits in the history of photography, you look at Karsh's portrait of Churchill. Or you look at Dan Budnick's portrait of Martin Luther King. I think it reveals so much about the personality behind the eyes.
One of the things you've talked about is how, and I'm thinking of that Churchill photograph. I think when he yanked the cigar out of his hand, and then he got that famous glare in that photograph. And you said that the really great photographs are the surprises, when the photographer knows enough to try to strip away the pretense and capture something authentic. Say a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, I think that's what makes a good photographer different from a great, great photographer. The really great photographers, I think, are as surprised whilst they're taking the photo, as we are when we finally see the completion of their work. And it's a really special skill to get a sitter to really reveal who they are. I mean, you know, lots of portraits, people are acting up or they're portraying an image that they want to project, whether it's truthful to their own personality or not. Particularly, you know, actors or performers, they have their persona that they want to perpetuate in the minds of their fans or audience. But a really great photographer will reveal something, I think, that surprises them.
I'm not even sure if we can apply that same idea to the era when photography was in its infancy and a daguerreotype was so new and novel. Is there something, I wonder, more genuine conveyed in this Joseph Smith image because the technology was so new and so novel? You know, the expectations and judgments hadn't really come yet. Maybe the performance wasn't there, or maybe it is always there. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, in this particular man, he knows he has to create a certain impression on the photographer and on, hopefully, the audience he's trying to sway or convince. I think back then, because we weren't inundated with images as we are now, it was fresher, perhaps, more impactful, because there wasn't 50 other photographs of Mr. Smith to compare it to. So the impact of this particular image would be stronger because it would be really original and fresh and, you know, evoke a "oh wow" reaction from the audience, which is apparently is what it's doing now, right?
It very much is. Yeah, absolutely. I wonder, I know it seems like an obvious question, the difference between a painting and a photograph, but one of the things you've told us is that this is how you put it. A photo is an arrow to the heart. It's immediate. Is that the main distinction? Is that the thing that makes the real difference here and the difference between a painting and a photograph?
Well, I think a great, great photo you can't ever forget. I mean, the particular painting that you showed me of Mr. Smith, I don't particularly think it's a great painting. There are great painters. You know, there's Rembrandt, there's Titian, there's El Greco, there's Velasquez, but whoever painted that portrait of Mr. Smith, it doesn't have much impact to me. It seems kind of flat and one-dimensional and doesn't hold my attention, doesn't actually reveal anything about the sitter and their personality, whereas the photograph does. And that's why I suppose I always gravitated to photographs rather than paintings, because of that immediacy.
It's interesting. What if you could disconnect your, you know, subjective impressions of a person from a photograph? What if it's not a figure from history with a famous backstory or a celebrity? What if it's a photograph of someone completely anonymous? And I'm thinking of some of the photographs in your book, Alice Mann's photographs, Martin Elcourt. There's a great image by Bert Hardy you have in your book of this Cockney couple, Sebastião Salgado, you know, people who are not famous. Can we get closer to a real impression of these people if we don't know who we are, if we're not, you know, burdened by some sort of bias, I guess?
Yeah, I think we can. And that's the definition of a great portrait. I mean, all those photographs you just mentioned had an effect on me. I didn't know the people, but I could relate to them. I could empathize with them. I mean, I was born, you know, in as a Cockney in the East End of London. So that Cockney guy sitting on the couch with his girlfriend, that's something I can relate to. I can relate to that environment. You know, it's not an opulent house. It's a simple one-room apartment, and there's a cup of tea on the corner. And it's not glamorous, but it's real, and it's honest, and it speaks to me. So I think we all bring our own personal histories when we're looking at photographs. And that's a good thing.
So let me ask you finally. So do you think then this daguerreotype, this image of Joseph Smith, will make a difference to believers, those who believe, those who think he's a charlatan or a con man? I wonder, will it make a difference seeing that actual real image, seeing those eyes? Does that make a difference?
I think it's very powerful. I think depending on the particular person's agenda, whether they're pro or against Mr. Smith, it is a visual manifestation. He comes alive for whatever feelings the audience, particular audience, has about him. It's tangible. It's not a notion. I mean, if there was ever a photograph of Christ, for example, I mean, it's people would love to have, or the notion of God, if there's a physical manifestation of it, it's important. It's important to them and important for the subject.
Peter Fetterman, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
It's Peter Fetterman. He's a photography collector and a gallerist. His new book is called The Power of Photography. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The program is produced by Kerry Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.